Hi, I'm Bubba Fairman from the University of Maryland, and you're listening to the DeFi and Dixie podcast on Inside Lacrosse.
Coming to you from the IL Podcast Studio in the Baltimore, Maryland, worldwide headquarters of Inside Lacrosse, it's the DeFly and Dixie Podcast, featuring Inside Lacrosse, ESPN, and Big Ten Network analyst, and my Hopkins homeboy, Mark Dixon. I'm your host, Dan Flynn. Dix, let's get it. Yo, Dix, welcome back. You were in Dallas all week. How was your trip?
Yes, I was. It was good. It was good. Dallas weather was unusual. Today, Thursday. So recording this on Thursday night, since I've gotten back from Dallas. It was 32 degrees in Dallas today, with some freezing rain and some wind and things like that. Yesterday it said it was 62. But I went out in the afternoon with some colleagues and we visited Dealey Plaza where John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Third time I've been there. Just a fascinating place for me to visit. I feel like I discover something new every time I walk through history. But it said it was 62 degrees, but by the time we got outside, it was like 50. By the time, then we stopped and had some dinner and got back to the hotel, like around, I don't know, 9:30. It was freezing. So it was like being back at home. It's like being in Baltimore weather-wise.
Yeah, the last time I was in Dallas, we were there for a showcase in the fall, and it snowed while we were the night we left.
What month? Snowing.
What month was
that?
It was in November.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's February. Happens.
Yeah, but still, like I've been to Dallas before in the February March timeframe, and it hasn't been this cold. But I've also been there in the summertime when it's been incredibly, incredibly hot.
Yeah.
It was a good meeting, national sales meeting. And, it was good to see my coworkers from all over the country. Wait, you don't do this full time?
I thought you were Mr. Lacrosse full time.
You officiate, you broadcast,
you're a dad, you're a coach, you're a fan. How do you have time for a full-time job?
I'm never too far away from the game, D-Fly. Don't you worry about it. All right.
All right. Hey,
something's got to pay the bills. Come on.
I hear you. So, did you tour the? You ever tour the like the book depository?
We did. So yes.
I did that once. It was really cool.
And I don't know how long that museum. It's a museum now.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long the museum's been in existence. I feel like the first two times I visited, the museum wasn't in existence, or maybe I went during a time of day where it wasn't open, but a lot has changed around that area. I first visited, I want to say it was back in maybe 2004, 2000, maybe, yeah, 2003, 4, 5, somewhere around there. And I don't remember it being as built up as it is now in terms of, it's always been a tourist attraction, and you always have the idiot savants, for lack of a better term, running around selling their wares, giving you their theories on what took place that day in 1963. But now, like the museum is, it's really, really nice. And the biggest feature of the museum is you stand where Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly stood while he shot John F. Kennedy. And you have that vantage point. You're looking through that window. They've recreated the boxes that he was situated between, and they have the rifle that he used. So it's pretty wild. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
But I love history, political science major in college. That's an event that people will argue changed the course of this country. And to be able to stand in the middle of it on the grassy knoll, They have big white X's where the president was shot twice. So it's crazy, man. It's wild. It's really cool. You know, I don't mean that, you know, it's really cool. It's just cool to like stand in the middle of history, something that's been intriguing people now going on what? That was November 22nd, 1963. So going on 50 years, just intriguing people, almost 60 years, right? If my math is correct. That's why I liked history, because I was never really good at math.
Yeah, what's amazing is how intact all of the grassy knoll, like the outside part, is
still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like nothing's been built over it or changed. And I realize it's a historical landmark now, but it's just a little odd. When you see it, you're like, wow, that's just like I've seen in the Zapruder film or in the JFK movie. It's the exact same today as it was in 1963.
Yep.
All right, let's.
Yep. So, good trip.
Let's get to some lacrosse. So we're gonna have a new number one this week. The number one Loyola Greyhounds went up the street to the U to play Towson on Wednesday, and Towson came away with a 12-10 win and looked very impressive along the way.
Really huge win for Towson. I had a chance to watch most of that game on replay via. On demand via LAC Sports Network. Biggest thing that stood out to me was the fact that Loyola, Pat Spencer, was not allowed to go off in this game. He scored early spectacular goals against Virginia, was dominant early against Johns Hopkins with some brilliant highlight reel type plays. Same against Rutgers in Loyola's first three games. His first shot of the game was saved by the goaltender for Towson, Canto, great save. Who knows if that shot goes for Pat Spencer, maybe this game goes differently for Loyola. It was just a strictly one-on-one against the Towson defender, Kobe Smith, a couple of phantom slides, fake slides, but you know, Spencer posted up with a nice high to low bouncer and Canto fought it off. And, second thing that stood out to me, Zach Goodrich is a man among boys playing college lacrosse this year. In 2019, he is manhandling his matchups. And the third thing is Towson's energy and their flow on offense. I really like the way that they move the ball. I really like the way they share the ball, and they're not afraid. Like, this is a team that is playing. They're not playing reckless, but they're playing loose and carefree. And their dodges to the goal were hard. They took all the space that Loyola gave them, which was quite a bit in the first quarter. I thought Loyola settled down defensively after that first period. But Towson, you know, just those three things. And I haven't even gotten to Alex Woodall.
Yeah, he was superb.
Haven't even gotten to Kobe Smith, who I think coming into this game, I believe he was tied for fourth in points on this Towson team. Now, he didn't spend his night, you know, going after assists and goals. You know, his primary assignment was Pat Spencer. And he did an admirable job. I mean, when you hold him, quote unquote, to a goal and four assists. But again, none of these plays were the highlight reel, back-breaking, deflating Superman efforts, you know, that we've seen Spencer make. It just takes all the wind out of the opponent's sails. Great night for the Towson Tigers. And who knows, maybe they'll be the king of the mountain come Monday in the IL media poll.
Yeah, there was great crowd on hand for a Wednesday in February to see that game, about 2,500 raucous fans. A comment that we were talking in the office, and my comment was, it looks like Towson is playing like April, May lacrosse in February. They just seem very, like the whole team seems organized and the offense is moving well. Loyola went to a zone at some point early in the game. Towson handled it without, you know, Loyola never plays zone. And they were ready for it. So it was, the Tigers look great.
Yeah, in session today, wrapping up the meeting, was getting texts from people asking if I was at the game or saw the game. And I'm like, oh, you know, I'm looking to catch it later on this afternoon. And their response was, I was there last night. I was like, wow, you know, these are 40, 50 some odd year old men, right, you know, sitting out in really cold temperatures. And, you know, obviously some of them had their kids with them. But Towson is, I mean, that was a huge game last night, two undefeated teams, you know, neighborhood rivals. And I agree with you with Towson, that their way that they're flowing right now, that's the word that when I watched this game back earlier today, just the flowing lacrosse that they're playing. It's just so smooth right now. I mean, now, you know, look, they're making mistakes. Don't get me wrong. They're not playing perfect lacrosse, but I think you could make that argument for a lot of teams here at the end of February, now beginning of March. Teams aren't as clunky as they used to be coming out of the preseason scrimmages.
I mean, clunky.
These guys are clunky. The stick work isn't there. The defense is way ahead of offenses. I just feel like 10, 12 years ago, the defenses had such the advantage over the offenses because systems and schemes and this and that and chemistry, what wasn't there. I don't think we're seeing that anymore. I know this is a little bit of a different year with the advent of the shot clock, but I just feel like teams offensively are really in a rhythm much earlier in the season. And Towson fits that bill perfectly. They're playing great lacrosse right now. And that was a fun game to watch. Two really, really good teams going at it. And, obviously I knew the result before I watched the game. But if I was watching that game live, it might be like, okay, when's Spencer going to take over? When's he going? Is this the possession? Is this the situation? Is this the scenario where he's just going to go off? And because you look at Loyola, Aiden Olmstead came back last night. Kevin Lindley continues to smooth shoot. And I mean, boy, that guy can sling it. Duffy and McGovern, double donuts for Loyola. And they've been a big part of their start, especially McGovern. He was held in check last night. And Chase Scanlon was also held in check last night to a large degree by the Towson Tigers. And give a lot of credit to Zach Goodrich in that sense, and the rest of his Towson defensive teammates. So it's just a really, really fun lacrosse game and goal and two assists for Scanlon, but still, we've seen his capabilities of making great plays. So I think Towson just did a really good job of limiting the big plays from Loyola and also the runs that Loyola has been going on so far in 2019.
All right, well, let's look to the weekend ahead. And another team that's been playing great lacrosse is the Richmond Spiders. They lost their first game of the season, 10-9, to Maryland, who's number 2 and undefeated. And then they've reeled off 3 straight wins. They're going to face number 6 Duke tonight, Friday night, at 7 o'clock. What's your assessment of this game? Richmond have a shot?
Oh, yeah, of course. The Spiders are playing, like you said, really good lacrosse. They were getting blown out by Maryland, made a 5-goal run in the fourth quarter to make that a 10-9 final. But since then, nice wins for the Spiders. And this is a really good Richmond team. It's playing with a lot of confidence. You mentioned the victory over Notre Dame just last weekend. So Duke doesn't need much motivation. They lost a High Point back a couple weeks ago. So a fellow SoCon member along with the Richmond Spiders. But let's not forget, 2016, Richmond beat Duke in the first ever meeting between these two schools. So it's not like Duke hasn't been bitten by the spider, so to speak. They have. And so they're going to come into this game eyes wide open. You have to love the way Duke is playing right now, manhandling Penn, winning by 10 goals a week ago. And that's a Penn team that was coming off of an emotional near-miss overtime loss to the University of Maryland. So absolutely, Richmond is very capable of winning this game. How will they defend the suddenly very dominant Duke attack? Joe Robertson, Joey Manown, those guys really doing a great job. I think how they defend those guys is going to be key in this game.
One of the teams we were just talking about, Notre Dame, now number 17 in the IL Media poll, takes on the number 2 Maryland Terrapins Sunday at noon. This is a big game for Notre Dame.
Love this game every year, even though Maryland's no longer in the ACC. The Irish has kept the series going with the Terps, and it's always an entertaining game. This is a series that had been defined. I think there were a number of years where the final score was 5-4 or 6-5, if I'm not mistaken. Last year was a scoring bonanza down at College Park, Connor Kelly, I believe, had 10 points in that game, and he was threading passes through the Notre Dame defense from the parking lot, it seemed. This is a Maryland team that's playing really good lacrosse. They had a great week last week, a midweek game where they came out and dominated Colgate in the first half and then managed that game in the second half. And then they had a nice effort against Navy this past weekend. So, you know, Maryland is a team that plays as daunting and as challenging a schedule as anyone in the country. And now they go out to South Bend to take on a Notre Dame team that's not happy, dropping that one goal decision to Richmond on the road last weekend. Will this game go back to the single digits that we've seen prevail?
I expect that it will.
Predominantly? Yeah, so that could definitely be a possibility. Or can Maryland, you know, Fairman, Wisnowskis, Bernhardt, DeMayo, can those guys generate the kind of offense that they were able to last year with Connor Kelly? It remains to be seen, but this will be a real nice game. I believe this game is on ESPNU this weekend, so that'll be fun to watch.
One player, as you mentioned, will be a key part of this game is Maryland's sophomore midfielder, Bubba Fairman, and I had a chance to talk to him, and here's that conversation. We're joined by Maryland's sophomore midfielder, Bubba Fairman. Bubba, thanks for joining us on the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Bubba, you guys are off to a super 5-0 start, ranked number 2. And as usual, the Terps are early favorites to get back to NCAA championship weekend and in that conversation. But for some reason, it feels like you guys have sort of flown under the radar a little bit, even though you've played some really good competition. What has been the key to your team's success so far?
So far, I think like a lot of it has just been consistency. I mean, we're trying to get better day by day, and each team that we've played has given us kind of a new look, so making adjustments. But like early season, the biggest thing is just like the little plays, you know, getting a tough ground ball, riding the ball back, you know, winning like a tough ground ball off a face-off. So I think we've executed a decent amount of those, and so it's allowed us to have success in the early season. But, I mean, furthermore, going down the road, we're going to need to just be more consistent all the time in every little aspect of the game.
Logan Wanauskas and Jared Bernhardt, proven scorers coming into the season, but I've been really impressed with what Logan has done, averaging nearly 5.5 points per game. What has been the change or the development in his game from his freshman and sophomore year?
I mean, for starters, that kid worked so hard over summer, lost a lot of weight, gained a lot of strength, and, you know, worked on his agility. So I think one thing that not a lot of teams really recognized going into this year was his ability to dodge. And I think that's elevated his game so much. And another big thing is, you know, the guys working around him. You know, we try to, our scout team gives us a good look on what we're going to see in the game. So Logan's had a lot of success because he's kind of adapted his game to go in and change it week to week. But the guys around him also, they work really hard just to kind of allow Logan to have success and set him up for those opportunities.
And what would you say that about your own game and, you know, development over the last season to this year?
You know, I've had some struggles, definitely, just having to step up in a new role. I mean, I had Connor Kelly and Tim Rotans last year that were so reliable, so consistent. They always drew the deep hole or the tougher shorty. And so, you know, last year was a little bit easier for me in regard to always getting the shorty and everything. And so this year's been a challenge, just learning to dodge a deep hole from up top, just kind of where the looks are, what I'm supposed to be doing. So it's been a challenge, but I think I'm getting there. And it's one of those things that just takes a lot of time. And, you know, I've just been trying to put in the work day by day, but slowly I'm getting there. I'm starting to understand the offense a little bit more. And
Danny Dolan takes over in goal and has been really solid, saving about 60% clip. What should people know about him and your defense?
For starters, Dan is an absolute stud. That kid is the most frustrating goalie to ever shoot on because he's just so good. And then defensively, I think we're pretty unified right now. We're still working out some kinks in the early season, but if we can get our stuff figured out and kind of button up inside, outside, one-on-one defense, I think we'll have a lot of success going down the road.
Your bio mentions that growing up in Utah, you grew up as a Maryland fan. How did you become a Terps fan? How did that come about?
I mean, so there wasn't a lot of collegiate lacrosse to watch in Utah, so the biggest thing was always just like watching ESPN for the games out. And I know Maryland was featured a lot. And as a young player, like, you always try to find someone that you could emulate or that you like the style of play. And so for me, I always grew up, I'd watch games and I just fell in love with Maryland for the way they played and kind of how hard they played. Just guys like Jesse Bernhardt, you know, Greg Catalino, Jake Bernhardt, all these guys, just the tradition behind how good their play was like one thing that appealed to me.
Now, you had to look out east for a team to follow. With Utah having a full-fledged Division I program, what do you think that means to young kids growing up in Utah now?
I think it's amazing. I mean, you can go now with Utah, you can go right down the street and watch Division I lacrosse game, and that's never been a thing in history in Utah.
Right.
I think it's going to help the game so much. It's going to allow kids to actually, you know, have a dream to play collegiate lacrosse after high school. Because, I mean, for a lot of kids going in before that, their dreams were kind of shut down because there wasn't really a Division I lacrosse team nearby. So I think it's going to expand the game so much. And, you know, the guys at Utah now are already doing so much for Utah lacrosse in general, but it's just going to expand the game so much.
I want to ask you about Coach Tillman. He's led the Terps to championship weekend an amazing 7 times in his 8 years there. So without giving away any program secrets, what is it about Coach Tillman's leadership style or personality that you think has led to such consistent excellence for the Terps?
You know, I think one of the biggest things that Coach Tillman does is, you know, he prepares you for the game, obviously on the field, but he kind of prepares you for the game off the field. Like, we have so many little things that we do throughout the day, and he always preaches us to do them to the best of our ability, hence, you know, be the best. But we're showing up for class, we have to be 5 minutes early, you know, just all these little things really help and correlate to the game. And that man just is so consistent with everybody and the way he coaches. It's so much fun to play for him because, you know, it doesn't matter if you're Jared Bernhardt or a walk-on to the team, you're going to be treated the exact same. And he's going to, you know, be as hard as he would with Jared as the last kid on the team. And it just really, like, makes it fun playing for him.
Besides Coach Tillman, who would you say are one of the two most influential coaches or people who've helped you develop as a player?
I mean, there's a multitude. I would just say one person that, like, has really given me a lot of opportunities and helped me along the way is John Ozissi. He's a close friend with a lot of guys at Inside the Cross, but he really helped me when I was young, just getting the tournaments, you know, like playing for teams. He always invited me no matter my talent level, but he pushed me really hard and he set me up for success with a lot of opportunities. And that guy has given me so much, and I just can't be more grateful for him. My family has been amazing through everything. Right. Kind of a weird recruiting process for me, but they were there the whole step of the way, and just really grateful for everyone that's kind of had an impact. There are too many coaches just kind of go down the list, but a lot of really influential people in my life.
As the Terps get ready to play Notre Dame, what do you expect from the Irish based on what you've seen on film?
I mean, they are an awesome team. Defense, they're so fundamental. They have this defense that is just so hard to beat. They're buttoned up. They play really smart. They don't overextend. They don't slide out of turn. They're just a really solid team. Offensively, they have a lot of really good players. They run a system offense. But we're really going to have to be buttoned up on defense and offense and just play fundamental and play like our coaches kind of make us play day in and day out.
All right, last question, Bubba. Have you seen the new logos and team names for the PLL teams, and what are your thoughts?
I have.
What are your thoughts? Anyone you like in particular?
We were trying to figure out what to call this play that we wrote up for this week, and we didn't have a name for it, so we went to the Whip Snake. It's just a pretty intriguing name, but yeah. I think My favorite team's the Redwood. I just like that logo. Yeah, the old bear on there.
Yeah, very California.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. All right, Bubba Fairman, thanks for joining us on D-Fly and Dixie Podcast, and good luck this Sunday and throughout the season.
Awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Have a good one.
So, Dix, I really like that kid. He's one of the favorites of all college lacrosse players in our office. Kid's got a great personality.
Great personality, very articulate, fun to talk to. I remember interviewing him last year after some Big Ten Network games, and he's just he was very precocious, you know, for such a young man, a freshman from Utah, no less.
Yeah.
His ability to handle the questions and, you know, just a very bubbly, effervescent personality, great for the game. And he's having a hell of a sophomore season. He was so I did a season preview for the Big Ten Network. And he's one of the first people I mentioned. I think he might've been the first person I mentioned for Maryland. And some people afterward were like, well, what about Bernhardt? I'm like, oh, Bernhardt's a great player, but I think Fairman is going to be your guy that takes that monumental leap that we see great players make, especially midfielders from freshman to sophomore. And I think we're seeing that so far out above Fairman.
Next featured game on our list is the number 8 Denver Pioneers traveling back to Tobacco Road for the second time in 3 weeks, hoping to come away with a better result this time when they take on number 20 North Carolina Saturday at 11 a.m. Where are they going to play this?
How do you like that?
Where are they going to play this?
Oof. I tell you, Keenan was a quagmire.
I've never seen anything
this past
like
weekend.
It.
That was bad. That was bad. And but hey, you know, maybe things have dried out. I'm not sure. I don't know the availability, but Carolina has that turf field that sat behind Fetzer. And I know Fetzer is still under construction. I don't know if Fetzer, I know it. Does Fetzer open this spring? Will
it's
the Heels play?
It's supposed to. Okay. It was supposed to open last fall for soccer, and they're way behind schedule.
Okay. So who knows if it'll be available this weekend, but it's been a while since I've been down to Carolina. They used to have that turf field that sat behind Fetzer. And I know Carolina played Denver there a handful of years ago. That game was on television. It was an odd broadcast.
It's 2 years ago.
Because there's not a lot of – yeah. So if there's a turf field available, I think they should be on it, unless Keenan has made an absolutely miraculous recovery. But that notwithstanding, you know, Carolina team that lost their first game, a hard-fought game against Johns Hopkins, Denver has proven that there is life after Trevor Baptiste. Ethan Walker has got his feet underneath him, had a great weekend last weekend as Denver scored a pair of victories over Utah and Cleveland State. But the thing I like most about Denver is their defense. I love the two Dillons, Dylan Gaines and Dylan Johnson. Alex Reddy, a little up and down, you know, struggled somewhat against Duke. Didn't get a lot of great goaltending there. But the big question is, will Austin French make his first appearance of 2019 this weekend against the Tar Heels? That remains to be seen. But defensively, Denver is a very, very talented ball club. Carolina last week against Hopkins, some shooting woes. But look, it was a terrible, terrible field, one that Hopkins ended up winning that game. So will Carolina's defense, how will they handle this prolific Denver offense that is still growing up but is very, very potent? And will they be able to score enough goals against Denver? And will the Pioneers get the goaltending they need to go into Tobacco Road and get that win, the goaltending they didn't get against Duke?
Let's move on to our marquee game of the week. Number 13, Virginia, at number 12, Syracuse, Saturday at noon. Dix, over the last two decades, this has probably been maybe the most exciting rivalry in all of lacrosse. Lots of one-goal games. The last four have been settled by one goal. This is going to be a thriller.
I think whenever you talk Syracuse and Virginia, everybody hopes that you get some semblance of a game that we saw, I believe it was 1997, what was that, the 22-21 game. Mm-hmm. And there's been some good Virginia-Syracuse games the last handful of years, don't get me wrong, but nothing has lived up to that 1997 game. Will this be the game? Will this be the one where these two teams just blaze up and down the field at the Carrier Dome and leave scorch marks on that turf. Both have the athletes. Both have the mindset now playing under the shot clock. I think Virginia a little bit more than Syracuse, but you know, Syracuse, I have to really tip my cap to the Orange. I thought they looked very, very pedestrian against Colgate, and give the Raiders credit. They won that game whistle to whistle. If you recall, I said I never thought at any point during that game Syracuse was going to win. They turn around, dominate Albany, and then fight off a very talented, tough Army team last weekend. So this is a team that seems to have found itself, found their identity. Brendan Curry, I think, is one of the best midfielders, not only in the ACC, but in the country. Then you got a Virginia team that made a goalie switch last week. And Patrick Birkinshaw came in and made, I think, what, two dozen saves against Princeton, which, okay, great, your goalie made 24 saves, but your defense is giving up some pretty darn good looks, and he bailed you out. So I think the Virginia defense continues to be a work in progress, but Birkinshaw, huge shot in the arm for this Cavalier team, who offensively can go toe-to-toe with anyone in the country. This should be a really, really fun game on Saturday, right? Is it Saturday up in the dome?
Yeah, Saturday. Saturday at noon.
Yeah, so I believe that game's on ESPNU as well. So it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I had a great conversation with Coach Lars Tiffany from Virginia, and here it is as he prepares for the Orange this Saturday. We're joined by Virginia head coach Lars Tiffany. Coach, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Dan, it's wonderful to be on the show. Love what you do for the sport of lacrosse.
Thank you. You guys have faced a difficult February schedule, and your team picked up its second win in a thrilling overtime win at Princeton. So first of all, congratulations on the win. Exciting game.
Thank you.
Ian Laviano, the ACC Player of the Week, scores the game winner in OT. But the really big story coming out of it was the play of your rookie netminder, Patrick Birkinshaw, who was incredible with 24 saves. What precipitated making the change to the freshman before a big road game?
We have a process here around our depth chart. Every Thursday during the spring semester, our coaching staff sits down and assesses and evaluates the practice and the week before. And we all have a vote. We rank them. We do it at every position, and it's to create more intensity and competition with our practices and pretty much everything we do. And when we assessed this last Thursday before the Princeton game, we watched some more film, and then we all had votes, and Birkinshaw was ahead of road. And so we gave him the start without looking backwards, without second-guessing it. It's commitment to a system that while – it's not for every coach and staff, and maybe something that you could pick apart and say, well, this isn't always the best thing. If your best player has a bad couple days, does that mean he's not going to start? But it's their system, and it's what we trust. And when we put Patrick in the goal, we had a lot of confidence in him because we felt he's our best goalie at the time. And he certainly stepped up, and I'm really, really impressed with his courage. You know, and I use that word, somewhat, haltingly, because true courage is on a battlefield and some other arenas. But he stepped in there as a first year, having never played a game, hadn't been in for a backup role yet, and stepped on the field like it was his domain, and it was his team, and he did a heck of a job in his first performance.
What else have you seen from your team that you like through the first four games?
Year three of Kip Turner, Sean Kerwin, and I being here in Charlottesville has been the year of decision-making, both on and off the field. And our focus is, can we become a smarter team? Year one was all about getting up and down the field as fast as we can, implementing the system, knowing that it's going to take a while for everyone to grasp it. Year two, we took a big step forward, and we started really changing the culture and more about the bonds, the trust within each other, within the locker room. That was what we attacked year two. Now that we've established that through some cultural Thursdays, readings, books, even some skits, year three now is, can we become a great lacrosse team? We're a good lacrosse team. We're not great. And for us, that next step is about the decision-making, understanding the schemes, communicating on defense with our slides, offensively, not going for haymaker punches every time, which is what we all love to see and want to do, but Can we throw some more jabs and be more consistent without always trying to go for the big hit? And so it's so to truly answer your question, Dan, what I'm seeing is we're seeing the evolution of the mental savviness and comprehension of our schemes. And now during timeouts, the level of talk is very different than it was a couple of years ago in terms of, hey, you know, what's the slide scheme here? What's the matchup there? What are they doing with their slides? And so we're starting to get, you know, starting to get to a new place in terms of our comprehension of the game, which I think can really set us up moving forward to try to take that next step to an elite level.
Tell me more about that communication system that you use in your style of play.
Sure. It's most teams have it. You know, we have numbers. We number the field when we clear the ball. We have number systems. And so, therefore, the players can talk and communicate utilizing the numbers. And I don't have to say, hey, look, the top right away from the box is wide open or high and away. We just use numbers. And, you know, it takes a year or so for the guys to completely make the nomenclature and the scheme talk second nature, where you don't have to think about it. It's just natural, where it becomes inherent to what you're doing and the process. So defensively, we want to be multifaceted. We don't want to just be a one slide scheme defense. And so during a scheme, during a play, can we make a call that puts us from one scheme to another based on the formation of the offense or what's easier for what we're doing? And that's taken a couple years, but it's really been rewarding to see the evolution and the understanding of that.
Your team's well known for their up-tempo style. Has the shot clock changed anything that you guys do or how you approach game plans?
It's a great question, Dan. It really doesn't change us much. It's certainly forced some other teams to be a bit more aggressive earlier in possessions. But I'm going to tell you this. I really still believe at four games into the season, the shot clock may actually be providing some more poise and patience for a team like ours. And what I mean by that is we now have another metric, another measurement to gauge a shot, a decision of a shot. You know, we rank shots 1s, 2s, or 3s, and 1s being the ones we want to take, the good ones. Well, now the metric include, hey, that you took that shot that we'd call a 2 with 45 seconds on the shot clock. Should we be taking 2s with 45 seconds on the shot clock? So the challenge there is we're holding our men to a higher standard. So first of all, as coaches, we have to prepare them that we're holding to a higher standard and not being unfair to our men. But how quickly can we start understanding that, hey, we'll take 1s earlier in a possession, and we don't want to take 2s unless we have to later in a possession, and just sort of growing and understanding that. So that's really sort of answers what I was talking about initially.
Yeah.
Becoming a smarter team and better with the decision making. But to truly answer this question, Dan, in some ways, I think the shot clock, because it's a metric sitting there and or staring over at the sideline or at the end line, it does maybe make us a bit more patient and more poised with our aggressiveness.
It's a very interesting answer, and it makes a lot of sense. Hey, one of your captains, Ryan Conrad, well-known, battled back from injury, and he looks really good in his senior year. What does having him back on the field and in the locker room mean to your program?
He's he's an incredible competitor, maybe just about the most competitive person I've ever met in all facets of life. He's earned his way into an incredibly difficult and successful McIntyre School of Commerce here at University of Virginia. And you have to earn your way with your first 3 semesters of academic work here at the university. And Ryan's a hard worker. He's an intelligent young man, but it's really, really difficult to gain entry in this program. And he's swinging way above his weight, you know, as he was able to achieve just through relentless work in the library and getting to know people and being a part of that program is a tremendous success for him. And he does that in everything, you know, and so we see it on the field as well. And just having his competitiveness, knowing that, you know, face-off wings against really, really strong face-off opponents and strong wing play, it just builds a lot of confidence in us knowing we have Ryan Wing flying in there picking up ground balls, especially late in games. And, you know, and he tied the game against Princeton to send it to overtime. And it's we're really lucky to have him. We wish we had him for one more year. This is going to be it. He's going to be in Wall Street with Credit Suisse starting the summer and no longer playing college lacrosse. But yeah, he gives us so much. And I think all of us look up to him, and especially when the going gets tough.
Let's move on to Syracuse. You grew up about 10 to 15 miles from the Dome. Any chance you were an Orange fan as a kid growing up in upstate New York?
You really didn't have a choice.
Right.
I grew up loving the Orange, bleeding Orange. And, you know, I was really lucky to grow up in Lafayette, New York. Lafayette, New York with the Onondaga Nation, obviously the original people of the game of lacrosse, the Native Americans, and certainly the Iroquois. I had many, many Native American friends, and I still do today. And the game is so popular in Syracuse, New York. And I first give credit to the Onondaga people, and I second give credit to Syracuse University Lacrosse. Because growing up, that's where a lot of the Native Americans and a lot of the non-Native, the white players who were fantastic Central New York lacrosse players, mm-hmm. went to college. And they played fantastic, fantastic, great lacrosse, winning that first national championship in 1983 when I'm a teenager and just loving everything Orange and lacrosse. And so I was very fortunate, actually, to be at that national championship game in 1983 because Joe Solomon, just about my best friend, his brother Travis Solomon was the starting goalie, and I got to jump on the team parent bus.
Wow!
And so it's been a part of my life, and now I go against him.
The Virginia Syracuse rivalry has been one of the most exciting in the sport for two decades since you've been playing every year. 20 of the last 28 games have been decided by one or two goals, and each of your last four meetings by just a single goal. As you guys prepare for your first ACC game with the trip to the Dome, what have you seen from the Orange this year as you prepare?
I'm seeing consistency in terms of Kevin Donahue running a well-oiled offensive machine. He's one of the best offensive coordinators out there. He gets a lot out of his talent, and he does such a great job of keeping the defensive coordinator on their toes and mixing and matching subtly his lineups on even, both on attack and at midfield, and making in-game adjustments. He's one of the best at that. But in addition, we're seeing a team defense under Leland Rogers really gelling, and they're keeping some good offensive teams in single digits and keeping a score down, and that's been really impressive to see. You know, and the goalie's getting a lot of credit and he deserves it. But I'm also seeing some really good defensive play in front of him, and so it's different than when I was growing up with my buddies and going to the Syracuse games, and it was a little bit more Wild Wild West style mm-hmm. of play. But Syracuse is they've done a really nice job of, you know, of the 66, the half-field setting, and playing really smart, sound lacrosse at both ends.
And getting back to your team, what's the Cavaliers' mindset as you go up to the Dome?
It's a we try to communicate to men. Hey, it's a season. The journey, each step along the way, is a great challenge. Regardless, it's hard to follow that, understanding that it's different when it's Syracuse and being in the Dome, but you try to as a coach. And hey, it's a big game, but they're all big games. And but when we go up there, it's a special venue to play in, and in front of a passionate crowd fan base. You know, that the game of lacrosse is very important to the people in Central New York, and so that's what's unique about it. And then playing our style, you know, exerting our will and who we are. And so it's an exciting opportunity against a really, really well-coached team. And can we get the tempo going to our pace? And if not, then the challenge is, can we better than them? That's something they're very good at, the 66 setting.
All right, last question, Coach. Just want to change the pace a little bit. I know you're 100% focused on Syracuse, but if you look ahead in the schedule, just one game, you see the Brown Bears on the Cavaliers schedule, your alma mater, your program you formerly coached. Any kind of emotion or feeling you think you'll have when you see the Brown jerseys on the other sideline?
Yeah, you know, that's going to be a difficult day. I've had a few moments like that in my past. You know, first when I was in 1999 and 2000, when I was an assistant coach for Rick Soule at Dartmouth College, and playing against Brown, coaching against Brown and Peter Lazagne, his teams there. And it was unusual at first, and it was a little hard for about 2 minutes. And then you just jump right into back to your job and coaching the men who you've been working with and you care so much about and put yourself a good best chance to win. But I remember I've had that opportunity before those 2 years when I was at Dartmouth. And then in a different sort of way, in 2016, when our Brown team played Virginia, and to be going head-to-head against Dom Starja, that was unusual. That was hard in some ways. And I can remember late in the game, and, you know, as we scored another goal and it looked like we were going to steal the victory, you know, this joy that I have, but then to look over and this man who I love and who's a mentor for me and the reason I became a college coach, you know, that my success means a loss for him. That was hard. So, yeah, you go through those as coach, and that'll certainly come up next week playing against the alma mater and men that Kip, Sean, and I recruited, and in some cases coached there as freshmen. And it'll be great to see him. And I'm certainly looking, you know, eager once the Syracuse game is behind us to zoom in on Brown, and because I know they've got some up tempo and fast pace, and they brought in some new recruits as well, who are very talented. But it'll be unusual. There'll be a lot of Brown alums. That's probably the most impactful to me, is all the Brown alums who are coming into town, who, you know, I hope to get to see and hug and have some food, you know, have a meal with, and that'll also be very distracting.
Well, Coach Tiffany, thanks for joining us, and best of luck this week and throughout the season.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Again, love what you guys do for the sport of lacrosse with the podcast.
Thank you. So, Dix, lots of exciting action on tap for this week, as usual. Just another weekend in college lacrosse with a multitude of exciting games.
The game continues to get more and more popular every year, it seems. February keeps getting better. You know, look, I know the weather isn't ideal, but we've got a lot of fans coming out to watch, a lot of interest, a lot of traffic on InsideLacrosse.com.
I think this year you have to
point to the new rules has really kind of revved things up a little bit. I think the pace of play is much better. The dive, although still very problematic, has proven to be exciting. The Air Spencer goal last weekend during the game that I covered, Loyola Rutgers. I mean, that was, you know, I probably dated myself when I said that's like a Michael Jordan dunk. I probably should have, you know, said a Kevin Durant or been a little bit more, you know, timely.
When
Spencer's shoe didn't rip and his foot didn't fly out of his boot. But I mean, you remember growing up when Michael Jordan was in the slam dunk contest and no one ever had taken off from the foul line and seemingly levitated down the lane through the air like Michael Jordan. And that's, I think, what we saw last weekend. And look, did he make contact with the goalie? Sure as heck looks like it in the replays. But, you know, the officials are on the field, and that is such a bang-bang play. And, again, I'll get on, you know, we need instant replay in college lacrosse for now, especially with the dive, to get those calls right. I think we've seen some illegal body checks that have been pretty out of bounds over the last couple of weeks, and it's hard to really ascertain the severity of those hits. If we had the instant replay like college football does, like college basketball does, college football especially, you'd probably call a guy for targeting. And there might be some ejections handed out if referees could go back and look at those hits, if they could go back and look to see if contact was made with a goalie stick, with a goalie's foot, with a goalie's arm, you know, those types of things. Yeah. But in any event, look, I'm always, you know, going to talk about the officiating piece of it, but just tremendous players, tremendous teams, great excitement so far in the early season that has us all really amped up for what lies ahead.
No doubt. All right, Dix, time for the give and go. If you're not familiar with this segment, this is how it works. Dixie's really good on his feet. I give him a topic. I give him my three answers, more or less. And then he has to weigh in on the topic, too. So here's the topic for this week, Dix. You ready?
Go ahead.
All right, you were just in Dallas. I love going to Texas. Lots of interesting thing there. Lots of interesting people in Texas. What are your three favorite things about going to Texas? All right, Dick, so here are my three. Ready? First.
Go ahead.
The barbecue, like the real barbecue. You know, a lot of people around here think barbecue like pulled pork, and you got your like your Carolina style or your like your Memphis barbecue. But no, they have like brisket and smoked meat, and you go into these places, these restaurants that are kind of like, it's almost like a buffet. Like you go get a plate and then you get your meat and then you get your side dishes and then you sit down at picnic tables and you just go at it. And they don't really have restaurants like that around here. And the food is amazing.
It's definitely different. Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
And you really got to experience it there. You got to go to one. There is a chain. There's like one in DC. I forget what it's called. It's called like
Texas Roadhouse.
No, I was just out of Texas Roadhouse.
Is that your go-to?
There's one in Columbia.
The old Ponderosa Steakhouse.
No, it's what's the place in DC? It's Hill Country Barbecue.
Old Country Buffet.
Hill Country Barbecue is the closest thing around here that you can get. It's like a big place. You get and you sit down on like picnic tables, but you go, you pick out your meats and your side dishes come separately, and it's sort of like a cafeteria style almost till you sit down for your food. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty commonplace in that part of the country. Second, the Cowboys. No, not Jerry Jones Cowboys. Certainly not talking about them. I'm talking about, it's one of the few places like in America, like, you know, if you lived in Europe or something, or some other part of the world, and you know, one of the stereotypes of America is like the cowboy or whatever, you know, the oil exec. They actually have them there. There are people walking around with boots and 10-gallon hats and giant belt buckles just walking around on the street, and it's amazing to see. Like, those people really exist. There's plenty of them in Texas. And then the third thing, I love that they have a real culture and community centered around sports. And it doesn't matter what sport is. You know, it's one of the hottest growing emerging markets for lacrosse, the Dallas area. But also, you know, baseball, football, you know, Texas Friday Night Lights, that sort of community and culture that's built around sports is something that I think is really cool. And certainly I envy being from Maryland. While we have an incredible high school lacrosse scene, I would have loved for, I wish high school football was bigger around here.
Yeah. Yeah. So good things. I've been to Texas a lot of times. I've been to Dallas, Houston, San Antonio are the three places I've been in Texas multiple times. Can't disagree with you on the barbecue. As a matter of fact, we went to a friend's house back in September. It was my younger son's football team after the first game of the season. A family had a cookout, and the guy is from Texas. And he used not a green egg, but like a red egg. And then he used just this huge grill. And I mean, I didn't know this guy too well. We got to talking a lot as well. The other pal, like, where are you from? I'm from Texas. And just the brisket, the sausage, the pulled pork, everything
the
just
chicken.
Tasted
it's so good.
Unbelievable. I mean, he had so much food and he had doggy bags, you know, and I was like, yeah, right here. We'll take whatever you
want. I know how you roll.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So, I mean, I think breakfast the next morning was
smoked
some of the meats, but you're absolutely right. Went to a place, this week called Wild Sauces. I think it was called that or something. It was pretty good. It wasn't the best I've ever been to, but it was good. And yeah, you're right. The barbecue and the cooked meats in Dallas and in Texas in general are fantastic. The second thing that I really enjoy about Texas, it's funny you bring up the Cowboys. I got back to my room last night, had a few drinks when we got back to the hotel, and I turned on the television as I was packing. And Tombstone was on, one of the greatest movies of all time.
I'm your Huckleberry.
And that's Wyatt Earp. Yo, Doc, Val Kilmer is Doc Holliday. Guy should have gotten an Oscar for crying out loud. But the Cowboys are the group that Wider, Doc Holliday, and his boys went after with the red sashes. Mm-hmm. So when you said Cowboys, I was like, oh, but you're right. The Cowboys are a huge deal in the state of Texas. You also have the Houston Texans down there, and in college football, as you mentioned, the Longhorns and the Aggies are gigantic. But the people, I really, really like the people in Texas. Everyone is nice. Case in point, last night walking back from Dealey Plaza, we were trying to find this place, Wild Sauces, and this woman with a cowboy hat comes up, sees us a Dallas Cowboys hat. She's like, "Y'all lost?" And we're like, "Yeah, we're looking for this place." She goes, "Oh, it's right up there, a couple blocks." One of the guys I was with had a Philadelphia Eagles jacket on. If that the roles were reversed, that we were in Philadelphia and someone with an Eagles hat came up to somebody with a Dallas Cowboys jacket, the fists are going to fly. So the people in Texas, that's just one case in point, but they're always willing to help you, willing to assist. They just have a very good nature to them for the most part. And last but not least, I have to, look, every time I go to Dallas, not every time, but every other time I go to Dallas, I end up at Dealey Plaza. That's just such a unique place, such a tragic place, obviously. But Dealey Plaza is great. The other place I really enjoy visiting when I have an opportunity to go to San Antonio is the Riverwalk. Just a great place of restaurants, bars, shops along the waterway down there in Texas and San Antonio. So, that national landmark is just really, it's wild. It's great, and always enjoy visiting it whenever I have an opportunity when I'm in Dallas.
This segment was sponsored by the Texas Visitors Bureau.
Yeah, look at you. I mean, favorite things about Texas. What did you just, inside lacrosse, just get some tourism dollars or something from a Texas club or Texas entity or something like that? You had to pay it forward.
No, it's a great place, and it's fun to, last few times I've been there is for lacrosse stuff. So it's great to see the sport growing all over the country, but especially there, for all the reasons we just said, it's a great place to go visit.
You just got me thinking though, we talk about New York pizza. Yeah, you're right. Every time you're in Texas, you got to get the Texas barbecue. No doubt.
Have to. All right, Dix, that'll wrap it up. Exciting week of lacrosse ahead, as usual. And if you like what you heard, please do us a favor and click on the subscribe button, leave a rating, and share it with a friend. You can reach out to us on Twitter at DixonLacrosse and at D_fly, or shoot me an email at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts. We drop a new one every day during the season. Have a great week and enjoy the games.